Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. The year 2004 was drawing to a close. Midterm election campaigns were about to begin. The Democrats had been the minority party since the midterm elections of 1994. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi was tired of being in the minority. She wanted to be Speaker. She called on Rahm Emanuel to lead the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or DCCC. She chose well. The Democrats took 30 seats from Republicans. President Bush called it a thumpin'. Chicago Tribune reporter Naftali Ben-David tells the story of the 2006 midterm elections in the new book, The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. On the program today, we'll look back at the 2006 midterm elections and how the Democrats, led by Illinois Representative Rahm Emanuel, won control of Congress. Ben-David had exclusive access to Emanuel and the DCCC in the year and a half prior to the elections. And Naftali Ben-David is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Naftali Ben-David is Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. He has served as the paper's Justice Department and White House correspondent since 1997. His book, The Thumpin', is published by Doubleday. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Naftali Ben-David, welcome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You note that usually the person chosen by party leaders to lead congressional campaigns is, quote, a distinguished senior statesman. This does not describe Rahm Emanuel. Would you describe him for us?
Yeah, especially at the time that he was chosen, he was an unorthodox choice, in large part because he'd only come to Congress a couple years earlier, and there were plenty of people who wanted to head the DCCC and spearhead the Democratic attempt to retake the House. But Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the Democrats, felt that she wanted somebody who was sort of a killer, somebody who knew how to go after opponents, who was a little bit ruthless, and who had no qualms about steamrolling not only people in the other party, but even people in his own party who got in the way. And that's why she chose him. He was a relatively youthful guy and a very intense guy and a guy new to Congress. But that is it's on him that she decided to stake her political future.
Yeah. How shut out of power were the Democrats heading into this campaign?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's hard to remember because now, of course, they control both houses of Congress. But back then, they were entirely shut out and had been shut out for some time. And I think it meant even more than people realize. You know, they couldn't hold any committee meetings. They couldn't conduct any investigations. The Republicans in the House were increasingly closing the doors so that they couldn't offer amendments. They sometimes didn't even get to look at legislation before it was voted on. It was hard for Democrats to even be hired by lobbying companies. Increasingly, as time went on, you know, the hammer came down, and the Democrats, it's almost like they weren't relevant anymore in the House. Speaker Dennis Hastert said that unless a majority of Republicans wanted a bill to come to the floor, it wouldn't even be voted on. He was almost like declaring that the Democrats might as well not be there.
No one expected the Democrats to win control. What were Emanuel's expectations going in?
Well, you know, he, along with everyone else, didn't really think they had much of a shot after the 2004 elections. When we think back on it, President Bush had just won a triumphant re-election. Seems like another era now, but it was a really resounding victory. The Democrats had lost seats, actually, in both houses of Congress, and there were some nonpartisan, impartial commentators who were predicting that the Democratic Party would be the minority party for decades to come, perhaps a permanent minority with a self-defeating mentality to match. So there was almost no one who thought they had any chance whatsoever. And Rahm Emanuel told Nancy Pelosi, when she asked him to take this on, you know, he said, I'll do it. But you got to understand, Nancy, that we're not going to win back the House this time around. We may win a few seats and perhaps set ourselves up to win back the majority in the future. But the odds are just too much against us, and we don't really have a chance.
Did he really, really want this job?
You know, I think that he did want the job. I mean, they went to him. Nancy Pelosi went to him. And he certainly had qualms about its effect on his family and other things. But he's a smart guy. He's a shrewd politician. And he knew that if he helped the Democrats gain some seats, that he'd be in a pretty good position. He's impatient. I think he, would love to be Speaker of the House one day. And winning a bunch of seats for the Democrats would endear him to his colleagues and put him in a position of power. And in fact, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Now, he had been part of the 92 Clinton campaign, and he was a close advisor to President Clinton. He stayed with the administration until 98, if I'm recalling correctly from your book. And going back, you know, a decade or so, he'd been a fundraiser for Paul Simon, and you report he would berate wealthy contributors if they didn't come through at a level that he deemed sufficient.
Yeah, it's a funny thing in a way. I mean, his M.O. going all the way back from when he was a young guy right out of college and was starting to cut his teeth as a political operative was scorched earth, as intense as it could possibly be, very often obscene, no holds barred. He just came at you 100 miles an hour. It must be said that not everyone thinks that's a particularly good thing, and he made enemies along the way. But from the very beginning, when he got into fundraising, that's right, he would berate donors in ways that they weren't used to. So if somebody was giving money, let's say, to the Daley campaign, which was one of his early campaigns, or the Paul Simon campaign, and he didn't think that they were giving enough, he would tell these established, you know, wealthy donors that they should be ashamed and that he wasn't going to accept a smaller amount than he thought was appropriate, and that that was just the way it was going to be. He would slam down the phone. Tactics that you wouldn't necessarily think would work, but his record ended up speaking for itself, and those campaigns raised a lot more money than people thought that they would, and as a guy who was in charge of the fundraising, you know, he's got to get a certain amount of the credit for that.
Yeah. I wonder what the relationship was like between Paul Simon and Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah, that's not something I know much about. At the time, Emanuel was a pretty young operative, so, you know, I don't mean to suggest that he and Simon were you know, bosom buddies. He was more of a young guy coming into politics. Paul Simon was already a pretty well-established figure. But you're right, their styles are very different. But it's not that uncommon in politics for politicians to choose somebody who is not necessarily like them, but who can get the job done.
Yeah.
And a hallmark of Emanuel's career was he was the guy who could get the job done. You might not like him. You might not approve of his tactics. You might not enjoy hanging out with him. But if you needed to raise money, if you needed to get votes, if you needed to put together ads, if you needed to do research on your opponents, he was the guy who could make it happen. And I think that Nancy Pelosi, that was her exact calculation. She talks about liking people who are operational. That's a phrase that she uses, and what she means by that is people who get the job done, who you know, don't talk about why the conditions are hard or why the task is difficult, but who, by hook or by crook, manage to make it happen.
Yeah. She is a loving grandmother, no doubt, but she's one tough politician as well. When did you meet Rahm Emanuel?
I actually first met him in 94. I was working for a smaller publication then called Legal Times, and he was in charge of Bill Clinton's crime bill. And he was tasked with pushing it through Congress, which, as you may recall, He successfully did, although it was a very dicey, tricky thing to get through Congress at that time. And, you know, the views of Rahm at that time were the same as they are now. That is, he was a guy who people thought screamed too much, who, you know, he was criticized for not being enough of a Democratic purist, for valuing victory over principles. But at the same time, he's charismatic to a lot of people. He was able to get the job done. And he has a lot of supporters as well as a lot of critics.
Yeah. Do you like him?
You know, I get a kick out of him, and I certainly enjoyed hanging out with him because from a journalistic perspective, he's a character.
He's a great intense guy. Yeah.
He's a good story. And, you know, when I was putting together what began as a project for the Chicago Tribune, what ended up being a book, you know, it was a great political story, but I felt fortunate as a journalist to have a character at the middle of it who was a very forceful, compelling character, that whatever you thought of his politics, whatever you thought of his tactics, he was somebody who captured and held your attention. And that's something that's important to telling a good story, of course. And I think even Emmanuel's greatest adversaries wouldn't describe him as a lukewarm or tepid figure, but rather as a strong and forceful one.
Yeah. Why did he agree to let you into the campaign, you know, with no holds barred, other than you would hold the story until the day after the election?
That has never been entirely clear to me, to tell you the truth. As you say, we had an agreement that I would have very unusual access for a reporter, sitting in on strategy sessions and listening in on conversations and phone calls and so forth. But he didn't want anything to be published before the election. He was afraid that that some ill-chosen word on his part or something that his staffer said, if it appeared in the paper, that it could perhaps destroy a campaign that he'd worked very hard to put together. So that was the one condition. But why he chose to do it, I've thought about that, and I'm not really sure. I think for him the downside was a lot more potentially a problem, you know, than the upside. But I guess he just made this decision that it would be worth it to have somebody there. You know, people have said, well, did he maybe think that this would make him look good and that a story like this could help him out? The only reason I don't think that is, again, he didn't really expect the Democrats to win. So it's not like he had the foresight to realize this was going to be an amazing victory and it would be great to have it chronicled. I think rather he expected it to be a relatively minor thing, and that perhaps that's why he agreed.
Hmm. That's interesting. You know, how do you get in? How are you someone like him and agree to do something with knowing or with thinking that your achievements may be modest?
I'm sorry. That wasn't very
well phrased, was it? You know, given his personality, his temperament, what's it like for somebody like that to take on a task and think maybe at best he could achieve modest success?
Well, I mean, I think that was frustrating for him. He hoped to exceed expectations. I think it's fair to say that was where the goal was. So if the Democrats were expected at the beginning of the election to gain maybe half a dozen seats, you know, he hoped to gain maybe a dozen. But I think throughout the campaign, there was this balancing of expectations and trying to have the party not be overly confident, but at the same time not have them be overly pessimistic. I think that the role of psychology in politics shouldn't be underestimated. It's sort of like sports, you know. Half of winning is believing that you can win. And for years, the Democrats were sort of spooked by Karl Rove. You know, mm-hmm. They felt like even when things were going well for them, Rove had their number, and somehow the Republicans would find a way to win. And I think part of Emmanuel's task was managing expectations in such a way that the Democrats started believing that they could win. And a flip side of that was really interesting to watch was that he kind of freaked out the Republicans. It was interesting to me to watch the Republicans get more and more nervous and jittery just about the fact that he had the role that he did, because he went out of his way to sort of play a head game and to send signals to the Republicans that he was coming after them and they better watch out. So the whole question of managing expectations, not only for himself but also for his party and for the opposition party, was a constant theme throughout the campaign.
Is Rahm Emanuel and Karl Rove, are they alike in respects other than that desire to have the psychological edge?
Well, they probably are alike in some other ways. I think they're both politically extremely knowledgeable and astute. They've both been political operatives their entire careers. They're both people who hit very hard and who really don't like to take no for an answer. But for me, as I say, the most striking similarity was this: the fact that they both understand the political head game better than a lot of their peers. I think there's a certain amount of skepticism toward the idea that psychology is an important part of politics, and I think it can be overstated. But at the same time, I do think that in some ways it's like sports. You know, there's always that team that seems like they can always beat your home team. You know, no matter how good of a season you're having, there's always the Dallas Cowboys or whoever it might be that somehow seem to have your number. And I think persuading the other side that you've got their number is important. And I think in the 06 election, it was interesting to see these two experts, these two mavens, sort of play a big chess game and try to psych each other out.
Yeah. Tell us the story of Alan Sechrist, 1988, and a gift that Mr. Emanuel sent.
Well, this is part of the legend of Rahm Emanuel. But it's a true story, and the story is essentially that that Emanuel, and at that time, was actually working for the Democratic House campaign. But at that time, he was a young staffer. This was many years ago, well before he was a congressman, and well before he came to the Clinton White House. And he was having a dispute essentially with one of the pollsters who was working for the campaign. And after the campaign was over, he and some friends of his in the campaign were talking about how angry they were at this pollster. And they came across an ad for a company that would send a dead fish to one of your opponents in a nice, beautiful mahogany box. I think the company was called Creative Revenge or something like that. So this, you know, guy in his mid-20s, Rahm Emanuel, along with a couple of his colleagues, sent Alan Sechrist a dead fish. And it precipitated a feud that seems like it's been going on ever since then. But it's sort of one of the stories that's always told about him, that he once sent a dead fish to one of his enemies. And it's a great story, and it's essentially true. But it epitomizes for a lot of people what he's all about, this sort of hard-hitting guy. It also epitomizes what a lot of people don't like him. I mean, you know, what kind of mature person sends a dead fish to an associate? But there's one key element of that story that I'll just mention, which is that notice he sent the dead fish to a Democratic operative, not to a Republican one. And a big part of the way he operates is browbeating, cajoling, you know, some would say bullying fellow Democrats to do what he thinks it takes to win. Of course, he has adversaries on the Republican side. That's what you'd expect. But one of the interesting things for me in following this campaign was the extent to which he was at odds with fellow Democrats on what needed to be done to win.
Yeah, and right after the polls closed, the night of the election, there were Democrats in the party who were after him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, I'd be the first to say that Rahm Emanuel is not the reason the Democrats won. I think the main reason is the war in Iraq, and a secondary reason would be the response to Hurricane Katrina, mm-hmm. and a third reason would be the Republican corruption scandals and the Mark Foley sexual email scandal. So I need to make it clear that I'm not in a position of saying that it's all because of him. His job was to get the Democrats in position to take advantage of whatever came, and what ended up coming was a Republican self-inflicted collapse, essentially. But that's right. There's been a lot of debate within the party about who gets to take credit for the victory. And predominantly that debate is between supporters of Howard Dean, who had what's called a 50-state strategy. He wanted to spend the Democrats' money all around the country, even in places where the Democrats didn't have a very good chance of winning, on the theory that you had to plant the seeds of future victories. And Howard Dean had huge fights with Rahm Emanuel, who wanted to focus the money on places where he thought the Democrats might win that November. And the two were always fighting, and finally they reached a truce toward the end of the campaign. But the battle continued even after the victory, where supporters of Dean were saying that he is responsible, supporters of Emanuel were saying that he was more responsible, and it's just this division that has affected the Democratic Party ever since.
Yeah. All these things, though, did come together, and Rahm Emanuel's part of it. It's a perfect storm kind of a thing. The war in Iraq, Katrina, the scandals with Tom DeLay, Jack Abramoff, Mark Foley, on and on and on.
It really was incredible. I mean, again, we have a way of moving on in politics, as we should, and I think one of the points I like to make is that the 06 election is very much still with us, and in my opinion is very much affecting the 08 presidential race that we're seeing right now. But it is interesting to look back at the string of catastrophes that befell the Republicans between President Bush's reelection in 2004 and the Democratic takeover of Congress in 2006, starting with President Bush's failed Social Security reform and moving into some of the things you've mentioned and even some that you've left out, like the Harriet Myers ill-fated Supreme Court nomination or the Dubai port scandal. I mean, things we've forgotten because they were rapidly eclipsed by some further disaster. It's really incredible. And to me, the underlying theme was that there was a party that had been in power a long time, and I think overreached in various ways, whether it's in terms of corruption, whether it's in terms of the war, whether it's in terms of domestic policy, and otherwise the voters seemed to decide that they'd had enough of one-party rule and wanted to at least give the other party a chance to moderate some of the effects of the Republicans in power. And again, Emanuel's job was to position the Democrats to take advantage of that, I think he did. I mean, I think it's hard to say that the guy in charge of the campaign shouldn't get credit when it ends up being a successful campaign. But he certainly has his detractors, and there are many within the party who would disagree. Mm.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Naftali Ben-David. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. He is the author of The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a caller in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi. Interesting conversation. As you started out the discussion, the term Blue Dog Democrat came to mind, and it seemed like they were supposedly in a position of influence, I guess Democrats being maybe progressive on economic issues and conservative on social issues. What has become of them, and have they made that much of a difference in the Democratic coalition?
I actually think they have. That's a very astute question. They played a pretty big role in the election campaign, and some of the Democrats who won, notably Heath Shuler in North Carolina and Brad Ellsworth in Indiana, were in fact conservative Democrats who are part of the Blue Dog group and in many cases were recruited by the Blue Dogs. And Emanuel had to work carefully with them because they really could help him out. The interesting thing about the Blue Dog Democrats is they often differ with the leadership of the party. They are to the right of the leadership of the party. But I think the recent election has, to some degree, strengthened them. It's increased their numbers in Congress. But one of the interesting things about the last election is that Democrats of all stripes won. So after the election, you did have liberal leaders saying, aha, look at all these liberal Democrats who won. It shows that the party is becoming and the country is becoming more liberal. And then you had conservatives saying, well, but look at these conservative Democrats who won. That just goes to show you that it's actually conservatism that's on the rise. In my view, it was basically an election that was about throwing out Republicans of all stripes and electing Democrats of all stripes. And it was a reaction of the electorate to a particular party as opposed to particular strains within the party. But the Blue Dogs was one of many factions that Emanuel and Pelosi had to work with and try to balance out against other factions in the party, like the Congressional Black Caucus.
I think you were exactly right in the three reasons you gave earlier about the Democrats winning. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you'd like to join the discussion anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So Rahm Emanuel gets off the phone with Pelosi in December of 2004. How and where does he begin his campaign?
Well, the place that he began was recruiting other Democrats to help him, to be part of his team, his campaign team, essentially. The group that he headed was called the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or the DCCC, but really it was him and whoever he wanted. And the people that he wanted were people like him, that is to say, members of Congress who'd come to power very recently and who had a history of sort of brutal attacks against their opponents, including opponents within the Democratic Party. So he recruited people like Chris Van Hollen, who's from Maryland, who had just come to Congress, and he did so in part by knocking off Mark Shriver, a respected Maryland Democrat with a famous Democratic name. And then he turned around and beat a Republican who had been in power a long time. And so he basically looked for other young killers, and he surrounded himself with people like that, and that's where he got started. And then the next step was recruiting candidates, and that was kind of an extraordinary story as well, the way that they looked all over the country for people who might be able to win, who might be able to knock off sitting Republicans.
And they were looking also for vulnerable districts. What was a vulnerable district? How did he select those targets?
Well, yeah, he was very methodical about that, actually, and he had a very specific definition for it. It was places where John Kerry or Al Gore in the previous elections had gotten at least 45% of the vote, because that would suggest that there was some Democratic presence, or open seats, that is to say, seats where a Republican had been there but was now retiring, or seats where the sitting Republican had some ethical questions surrounding him or her. And he added up those three categories, and that came to something like 80 seats. And in the end, they didn't challenge the Republicans in every one of those, but in something like 50 seats, they really played an active role, running television campaigns and television ad campaigns and investing some serious resources into those races. So there's a very specific look throughout the country at which districts made the most sense where they thought they could pick up seats.
Yeah, they did well in Indiana. How did they do so well in Indiana?
Well, that was one of those striking things. As you say, they did well. There were three seats that were held by Republicans a year ago that are now held by Democrats. Part of it, I think, was very good recruiting, where they got some real star candidates. And the one who jumps out at me there is Brad Ellsworth, who is a sheriff, good-looking guy, conservative, quite conservative in many ways, against gun control and so forth, but, you know, right for that district. And there were also, as I understand it, some local issues in Indiana that probably didn't have much to do with Rahm Emanuel or the DCCC. It just goes to show you how politics is not always the most predictable thing. But there were issues related to a toll road and other things that played as well. And so that turned out to be a good state. Pennsylvania turned out to be a good state for the Democrats. And now, as we look ahead, a lot of those Democrats who won in conservative areas, they're the top targets for Republicans in 08. And one of the big questions is going to be how many of those 30 seats that the Democrats took they'll be able to hold on to next time around.
Yeah. What do you think of what's coming up in 2008? How are the 2006 election results setting the stage for what lies ahead?
Yeah, I think that the elections very much did set that stage. What you see, broadly speaking, is a resurgent, but I think still insecure, Democratic Party going up against a wounded but still very determined Republican Party. And that dynamic was set up by the 06 elections. In a more direct way, you're seeing the Democrats raise a lot more money than the Republicans. There's a lot more excitement surrounding candidates like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on the Democratic side than you're seeing around, say, Mitt Romney and Rudy Giuliani on the Republican side. There are a lot of reasons for that, of course, but I think a big one is that Democrats are sort of thinking, hey, we can win, you know. Things are going our way. The public is disenchanted with the Iraq War. It's not some ironclad rule that Republicans have to win every single election. So I think there's a huge psychological impact of that election, and I think it really has set up the dynamic of what's going on. In a more, even more direct way than that, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have close ties to Rahm Emanuel. Barack Obama came up through Chicago politics, as did Emanuel. They're friends. You know, they've had dinner together. They share some consultants. But Rahm got his start with the Clinton White House, and he has a certain real loyalty to the Clintons. So both the Clinton campaign and the Obama campaign would like to have Emanuel as a supporter. So far, he's avoided throwing his support to one or the other. He doesn't want to, I think, upset the other campaign, but very much going forward, he's going to be playing a role in the upcoming campaign.
Hmm. Meanwhile, with the Republicans in Congress, the Republican CCC, It seems to be the story now at this moment that they're doing their best to sweep the president into a closet and lock the door.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that you're seeing candidates run away from President Bush. That also happened in the last election. But I think given the results and given the president's continuing fall in the polls, you're seeing more and more of that. It's interesting, actually, the head of the Republican campaign committee, a guy named Tom Cole, congressman from Oklahoma, he ran to head that committee by telling his colleagues that he was going to be the Republican Rahm Emanuel. So that even with all the hostility and resentment of Emanuel on the Republican side, they still felt like they needed somebody kind of like him on their side. As for the Democrats, the guy who's now heading their congressional campaign is Chris Van Hollen, the guy I mentioned earlier, Democratic congressman from Maryland, who was Emanuel's top deputy, essentially. And now that Emanuel has moved on, Van Hollen has taken his place. So you very much see the effect of the last campaign on the current campaign.
Mm. This idea of going ruthless, this tactic, I would imagine that there are people listening to us this afternoon who are saying, you know, is this in the long term harmful for the country? Are we hurting the process?
I think that's a very good question. And let me start out by giving a couple examples of what we mean by ruthless, because it's a word that's easy to throw around, but a little harder to define. I'll give you a couple examples. In a race in the 6th District of Illinois, which was a race that got a lot of coverage with Tammy Duckworth and Pete Roskam, there was initially a Democratic candidate there named Christine Sigelis, who was a grassroots candidate. And had a lot of support, sort of populist support. But Emanuel was convinced that she could not win. And so he, along with Dick Durbin and Obama and others, did what they could to force her out of the race. They sort of steamrolled her, even though no one was disputing that she was a good Democrat and had sort of done her part. They felt that she was unlikely to win. So they threw all their support behind Tammy Duckworth. So they steamrolled a fellow Democrat, in other words, in the interest of ultimate victory. Should be said that they ended up losing that race anyway, but that was the goal. Another example is the way that they would lean on people to give money. Members of Congress who are Democrats are supposed to give money to the Democratic House campaign. And Emanuel was brutal about calling people up and harassing them and forcing them to give the money that he felt that they should give, you know, to the campaign. But anyway, to answer the broader question, you know, I think there's a pretty good argument that it is really a shame. I mean, that who wants to see our political system be nasty and demeaned and dehumanized in this kind of way, depend so much on money, depend on nasty negative attacks against the opposition, all those things. And I wouldn't disagree with that. I do, in the end, think that there's no other way. It wasn't really working for the Democrats to try to be nicer or to be purist. It just seems that it wasn't going to work, and so it might be something that we can and should bemoan. But I'm not sure it's something that's avoidable.
No turning back.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that given the way things are, the stakes keep on getting upped in every election. Somebody comes up with a new nasty tactic. Somebody comes up with a better negative ad. Somebody raises more money. And there's no alternative. There's nothing. I mean, it's hard to think of what we could do to make the system nicer. And it's, in a way, ever been thus. I mean, from the beginning of American politics, there were nasty campaigns against one's opponents and everything from, you know, stuffing ballot boxes to spreading evil rumors. So, I mean, I very much sympathize with people who are incredibly turned off by the political system the way it is, and I share some of that. I'm just not sure what the realistic alternative is.
Mm. Is ideology at all important to Emanuel?
That's a question that comes up often because his critics say his ideology is winning and he doesn't care what you believe and he has no beliefs of his own. I think that's a little bit unfair because he certainly has plenty of policy proposals. He wrote a book in the middle of the last election called The Plan that laid out what he and his co-author thought was the right way for the country to go. And I think, broadly speaking, he is a Clinton-centrist Democrat. So I don't think you can say that he has no principles. But at the same time, he's not a guy with grand vision. He's not somebody who inspires. He's not somebody, even like Bill Clinton, who had a very broad political philosophy that had a certain amount of specifics to it, but also incorporated a larger vision. I mean, that's not who he is. He is a guy who is very good at tactics, who knows, again, how to get things done. And, you know, without saying that he doesn't believe in things, I think this idea of having sort of a larger vision, that's not his strength.
Yeah, he's the operative.
He's the operative. He's the guy, you know, exactly. He's the guy who knows what kind of ads to run, how to raise money, you know, what's the best way you can put your opponent on the defensive. He's not the guy who's making either the grand inspirational speech or toiling away at an office to come up with what should be the next doctrine of the Democratic Party.
Hmm. His interest in politics goes all the way back to high school when he was knocking on doors, what, for Abner Mikva?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he grew up in a fairly political family. His mother was very active in the civil rights movement and in Illinois Democratic politics. And so that's right. In high school, he was stuffing mailboxes for Abner Mikva, who was then a congressman. And it just sort of went on from there. As we discussed earlier, he worked in Paul Simon's campaign. Mm-hmm. He worked in Mayor Daley's campaign, and it's just sort of moved on, you know, through the Clinton White House and really had a political career from the beginning.
So is it fair to say, this goes back to something you said earlier, but just to reinforce it here, do we see his love of politics as a sport, and yet also he's concerned about politics and political issues?
Yeah, I mean, that's something, you know, I guess that ultimately goes to somebody's internal psyche and is a little hard to, you know, to tease out. I mean, I think he's a guy who loves the game, and I think he's a guy who loves to win. And if you were to ask me, as somebody who's followed him a lot, I think those are his predominant characteristics. So that's not to say that he doesn't have a coherent political philosophy, but it is to say that his prime mover is the idea of winning. That's just my observation of him and the way he works.
Yeah. Has he changed fundraising now forever as well, given, you know, you described how he'll get on the phone and just hammer away at folks?
I think in a certain way he has. It's a little hard to pin down, of course, whether he's a product of the system or someone who's helped shape it, and the answer is probably a little bit of both. But he's been, you know, the amount of money going into politics, as I think most of us know, has just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, as we're seeing now, the huge amounts of money that the presidential candidates are raising. And, you know, he's been part and parcel of that. I mean, going back to the Daley campaign and Simon campaign, and then very much in the Clinton campaign, and on through the last congressional campaign, you know, he played a very big role in raising huge amounts of money, pressuring people to contribute money, pressuring people to raise money, and just recognizing the value of that within our system. And, you know, that's one of those things. It's not necessarily the most attractive thing, but I think he's somebody who has been a big part of the growing role of money in our political system.
Yeah. Would he bemoan that at all, or is he just, matter of fact, that's just the way it's done and you got to do it?
I mean, I think the latter. I think his style is sort of matter of fact. He doesn't spend a lot of time bemoaning the way things are. He's a guy who looks at the way things are and figures out the best way that he can take advantage of that. That's not to say that he wouldn't be in favor of reform and so on and so forth, but I don't think he's a guy who spends a lot of time, you know, wishing things were better. He's a guy who, as I say, who figures out what the rules of the game are and how he can use them in the most extreme way to his advantage.
Mm. Naftali Ben-David is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. He served as the paper's Justice Department correspondent and White House correspondent since 1997. He's the author of The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, we've got 5 or 6 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. How did Rahm Emanuel help his candidates achieve success? What were the themes of the campaign rhetoric that he helped his candidates craft?
Well, there were a few big ones. One of them was this idea of the culture of corruption on the Republican side. and the other was the idea of the rubber stamp Congress. So these were two big themes, and they were basically negative themes, critical of the Republicans, that they were corrupt and the only way to change the system was to throw them all out, and that they marched too much in lockstep with President Bush. There were other positive themes as well, having to do with raising the minimum wage, with a better energy policy, that sort of thing. But I think first and foremost were those two slogans and the message that they embodied, the culture of corruption and the rubber stamp Congress.
When William Jefferson's offices were raided in May of 2006, what was the mood in the Democratic congressional campaign camp?
I mean, I think the mood was great frustration. Yeah. You know, they had made great headway with a culture of corruption slogan. And here was this guy who was caught, according to the FBI, with $90,000 in his freezer in bribe money, or at least sting bribe money. And it really muddied the matter and made it hard for them to portray the Republicans only as corrupt. And so there was a great deal of frustration. And a wish that Jefferson would resign or something like that, which of course did not happen.
Yeah. Well, what did they do for damage control? Pelosi quickly turned on Jefferson, kind of a rapid response there.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing that they did, and it was mostly Pelosi who did it, was force Jefferson off a key committee. And that enabled them to say, look, unlike the Republicans, when one of ours does something bad, we take action. You know, compare that to the lack of accountability on the Republican side. So that was the message. And beyond that, the response, I think, was just to keep hammering on Tom DeLay, Mark Foley, whoever else it might be, and talk about the corruption on the Republican side.
Yeah. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hi there. I just have a quick question that I can't resist asking, which is a little bit off the subject, but how do you see things working out in terms of the Clinton-Obama, race for the nomination? And I don't mean how do you think it's going to end, but what's it look like right now to you?
Well, I have no crystal ball or anything like that, but I think that Hillary Clinton has an unbelievable organization, and I think she looks stronger right now. She's leading in all the polls, even though Obama has gotten tremendous and deserved, I think, positive press for the amount of money that he's been able to raise. And he's certainly an inspirational figure for a lot of people. But I'm consistently impressed with how Hillary Clinton has something going on in every single state with the coordination of her messages and her activists and just the way that campaign is put together. And so the way I see it right now is you have a very definite front runner in Hillary Clinton, notwithstanding the amount of money that Obama's been able to raise.
Okay, I have, if I might, one other question. That,
sure.
That's looking at the primary,
yes.
Who gets nominated. Are there any polls around that look at the bigger question, which is she may have the nomination, but can she win the election?
Yeah, there have been all kinds of polls that have various theoretical head-to-heads. You know, if it's Hillary Clinton and Rudy Giuliani, who wins? If it's Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney, who wins? If it's Barack Obama and John McCain, so forth. And they show all kinds of mixed things, from what I've seen. They show a pretty tight race, and they tend to show a little bit of an advantage for one side or the other. The difficulty with those polls, I'll tell you right now, is they don't look state by state. And the way our system works is state by state. As we all know, Al Gore got a lot more votes than George Bush and lost the election. And so I haven't seen any sort of a sophisticated analysis that goes state by state and shows what might happen. What I think you're asking is, there's a great deal of trepidation on the Democratic side that she'll be able to win the nomination with some ease, and then she'll have great difficulty winning the general election. I think that's a very real fear on the Democratic side. And Barack Obama, it has to be said, is using that pretty effectively to his advantage. He's making that case, maybe not directly, but certainly through signals that whatever you think of Hillary Clinton, she's going to have a tougher time winning. She's a polarizing figure. I'm the guy who might actually be able to win.
Okay, that's where I'm at. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. On the Republican side, where are the strong operations?
Well, again, there's so many people in this business who who make predictions with a great deal of certainty, and I'm not one of them. But I have to say that perhaps you've heard today John McCain's two top advisors quit. His campaign is, I think, fair to say, in a pretty serious tailspin. It's difficult for me to see him recovering, although I suppose anything can happen. I have difficulty seeing Rudy Giuliani winning, just because his positions are so at odds with much of the Republican Party. I think Mitt Romney, and he certainly has vulnerabilities too, I think he's run a very impressive campaign. He's not winning, he's not leading, you know, in the poll numbers throughout the country, but he is leading in some of the important early primary states, which was exactly his plan. Of course, there's a wild card in the entry of Fred Thompson, which is expected in the next few weeks. Nobody knows what's going to happen there. Right now, his poll numbers are high, but, you know, it's kind of easy for your poll numbers to be high when you're not in the race yet. I mean, Al Gore's poll numbers are high, too, and I feel that if he entered the race, you know, there'd immediately be more scrutiny, and it would be hard for him to sustain those high poll numbers, and that's something that may well happen to Fred Thompson, too. We'll have to see, but so far he hasn't been subjected to the kind of scrutiny that a candidate would get. Mm-hmm. So he's not a candidate yet, and on the Republican side, in my view, Mitt Romney has done surprisingly well.
Okay. One last question. Quick thought on the effect of pushing up primary dates on the presidential landscape.
Well, that's just going to increase something that is a trend that's been happening more and more in recent years, which is that the person who starts out with the greatest name recognition and the most money and the most advantages to begin with is going to be most likely to get the nomination. It's going to be harder for, let's say, a Jimmy Carter to little by little build support and ultimately end up with the nomination, you know, or a George McGovern. There's so much that has to happen on February 5th. Very early in the campaign, you have to have a ton of money and a ton of name recognition to win a whole bunch of states that all have their vote at the same time. It's almost like we now will have a national primary day, just like we have a national general election day. And so I think that's going to ultimately be the outcome. It's going to help the front runners even more and make it even harder for a dark horse or maverick candidate.
There we have to leave it. Naftali Ben-David, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Naftali Ben-David is the author of The Thumpin' How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution, the publisher, Doubleday. It is 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from Kansas City and Chicago. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From Kansas City this afternoon, futures in the July wheat pit at $6 on the soft, or rather hard red, even. Up 2 cents. They were $6 on their settlement with a high of 606 and a low at 599. That for the July hard red winter wheat from Kansas City. The September there settled at 590. They were down 0.75 cents. From Chicago, nearby July wheat, 592, the settlement price up 3.5 with a high of 601 and a low at 591 on the harvest month for the soft red. September, 610.5 the high, the low at 98.75, their settlement price at $5.99.5. They finished 3 cents higher for the day. December contract now, 623 and a quarter the high, the low at